On this episode of Newt's World, we're going to talk about H.R. 1, the For the People Act, or as I more accurately describe it, the For the Corrupt Politicians Act. It's an enormous avenue for election fraud. And I think it's very important to recognize that it passed basically by a machine vote, 220 Democrats for, one Democrat against, 210 Republicans against. The only Democrat to vote against it, Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi. The act is over 800 pages, making it hard to sift through all the details. But the one major issue of the act is it takes away the role of states to regulate their own elections. Instead, it creates a federal mandate for a one-size-fits-all Nancy Pelosi bill. If Americans truly understood what is hidden in H.R. 1, there would be almost no support for it. And no one knows that better than my guest today, Hans von Spakovsky. Hans is the leading expert on voter integrity at the Heritage Foundation, having worked on the issue of free and fair elections for decades. Thank you for joining us.
Newt, thanks for having me.
I did notice that you've both been writing about this and talking about this. Can you explain what tipped you off that H.R. 1 might not, in fact, be for the people, as the Democrat machine claims?
Well, I knew this bill would be a problem the moment I started looking at it, and I started looking at it immediately because it was the very first bill that Democrats introduced, which emphasizes how important they thought it was. And I was shocked as soon as I started looking through its provisions because of the massive changes, bad changes, it was making in the administration of our election process, and frankly, also changes in federal campaign rules and regulations. And the bill, in essence, was taking all of the bad policies that Democrats have been pushing for years, all the terrible changes that were made in last year's election, cementing them in place as federal law, and then making things even worse. It's 800 pages, Newt, but the overall goal of this bill seems to be to do two things. Make it easy to cheat in elections and manipulate election results, and two, silence and chill the speech of anyone who's willing to criticize what Democrats are doing.
You said recently that it is an 800-page monstrosity. That's pretty strong language. And then you wrote in a recent article for Fox that there are eight really bad parts of H.R. 1. Can you highlight some of these sections?
Sure. Probably the one that folks will understand immediately is the fact that it guts state voter ID laws. No state would be able to ask someone for an ID to authenticate that they really are who they say they are. Instead, the bill says that states have to simply accept a form signed by the voter saying, yeah, I really am who I say I am. So that, Newt, as I'm sure you realize, means I could walk into a polling place, claim I'm Newt Gingrich, and if they questioned it, because we don't exactly look alike, as long as I signed a form swearing I was you, they would have to let me vote. That in itself is probably one of the worst aspects of the bill. But when you combine it with other provisions, for example, it requires same-day voter registration. So that means every state has to allow individuals to walk into a polling place, register, and immediately vote. Now, obviously, that gives them no time whatsoever to verify any of the information they're being given. And since they can't ask you for an ID, again, I can walk into any polling place anywhere in the country, make up a name, make up an address. They have to allow me to vote. And even if they have any questions about it, they can't ask me for an ID. To make this even worse, it has a severe limitation on the ability to challenge someone because you don't believe they're eligible to vote. Election officials can be charged with a criminal violation of the law for challenging the eligibility of an individual. So it's as if they want to make it easy to cheat and easy to get away with it, and they don't want anyone detecting it. I mean, on top of that, you can add things like, again, absentee ballots. Not only can states not require an ID for an absentee ballot, they can't even enforce a witness signature requirement if they're smart enough to have one. Many states have that. It's a smart move intended to protect voters. It's a way that you have a witness who can authenticate that the voter actually filled out the absentee ballot. That's now out the window. No state can enforce a witness signature requirement. Newt, it's just one thing after another like that, including all these provisions that impose these very strict and severe standards that will make it very difficult for states to maintain the accuracy of their voter rolls, making it very difficult to, for example, take people off who have moved out of state or otherwise are not eligible to vote. They can't even take somebody off despite the fact that they never respond to any official notifications from election officials and never vote. No, they'll have to stay on the voter list regardless of any of that for the next century if that's what happens.
They indicated that you have to verify the signature of every person who is filing the petition to recall the governor. So they actually currently have stricter rules for proving who you are to recall the governor than they would have under H.R. 1 for electing the governor.
That's exactly right. I can't even summarize all the bad provisions. Another bad one, which you will recognize, is, again, with regard to absentee ballots. Remember, absentee ballots are the most vulnerable ballots because they're voted outside the supervision of election officials and outside the observation of poll watchers. So that's why a lot of states, while they allow a voter to return his ballot, they allow members of the family to return their ballot. They don't allow complete strangers to go collect and pick up absentee ballots. So that's a very dangerous and risky idea because it allows people who have a stake in the outcome of the election, including political operatives, to get a hold of people's ballots. So many states prohibit that. If H.R. 1 becomes law, that would override all state laws like that because Democrats want their political consultants and political operatives and campaign staffers to be able to go to people's homes and pick up their absentee ballots. That would now have to be legal in every single state.
Because you understand the history of elections, doesn't this reverse almost 100 years of trying to get to an honest, accurate, secret ballot system from a system that had been amazingly corrupt and dominated by the machines? I mean, aren't we literally seeing a reversal back to a 19th century model of machine politics?
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. I think a lot of people, for example, take the fact that we have a secret ballot for granted. The secret ballot wasn't in existence for more than 100 years of our history, and the corruption, the voter fraud across the country was massive in many areas, particularly, for example, in New York City. And almost all of the rules that we've developed over the past decades, everything from actually requiring people to register to vote prior to election day so that their information could be verified, to the secret ballot itself, to requiring an ID, those are all provisions put in place to try to stop the kind of fraud that occurred in prior elections in America. Look, the Supreme Court recognized this, Newt, as you know, in 2008 when it upheld Indiana's new photo ID law, because when it said that the U.S. unfortunately had a long history of voter fraud been documented by journalists and historians, and it could make the difference in a close election. And of course, we have close elections all the time in this country.
What do you think is the motivation? I mean, do they really want to impose a sort of a reversion back to the old Tammany Hall model of dominating the election by machinery rather than by the voters?
You know, look, you've been dealing with the left for a very long time, and my impression of them from my dealings with them is that they believe the end justifies the means. And to them, that means in the election area that, well, if cheating can occur as long as it benefits them and gets their people into office, well, that the end result of that is good. I'm not sure what other conclusion you can come to, given many of the provisions being put into this bill. And again, I'll give you an example of this. This bill would require all states to put in automatic voter registration. And it specifically says that, in essence, any state agencies that you as a resident of a state have an interaction with, whether it's an unemployment office, a welfare office, DMV to get a driver's license, every single one of those agencies would then have to forward your name to election officials and they would automatically register you without asking you. Not only state agencies, But this bill requires federal agencies to also get involved, and they list them. And it's everything from the Department of Defense to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Now, Newt, you and I both know what that's going to lead to. First of all, I don't think there's anybody out there that only has interactions with one state office or state agency. So you're going to get lots of people who are registered multiple times. Also, obviously going to happen because I'm in federal databases too, just like everybody else. So you're going to have multiple registrations of the same person in the same state, multiple registrations of the same person in different states, and you clearly are going to get people who are ineligible to vote, like felons and aliens, also being registered to vote. And is that the intent of the people who put this law together? I think it is, because, for example, with regard to aliens, because in fact, there's a provision in the automatic voter registration part of the bill that says that no alien can be prosecuted civilly or criminally or in any kind of naturalization proceeding because they got registered to vote through this part of the bill.
So in effect, you now have an open border. So you're having a flood of new people pour into the United States while they're trying to pass a bill which would allow these people to register to vote illegally with no consequence.
That's exactly right. Despite the fact that it's normally a felony for an alien to vote in a federal election, they want them to be able to register to vote and to get away with it. And I think that's very clear from the way this particular bill is written and all of the restrictions it imposes on election officials being able to do anything about this or to, like I said, clean up their voter list or challenge the eligibility of an individual they don't think is eligible to vote.
John McLaughlin did a survey in Arizona on this bill, partially, I think, to see if they could impact the two senators in their votes. They're finding amazing numbers. 70% of the country opposes abolishing voter ID. This bill is 800 pages because it packages virtually every bad idea about elections that the left has into one vote. So instead of having to go back and pass 10 bills, they're just passing one gigantic bill. One of the provisions provides for tax-paid funding for campaigns. Well, it turns out by 77 to 17, the American people oppose taxpayers having to fund politicians and their campaigns. Now, as I understand it, I have to confess I don't know much about this. New York City already has a system, something like that. Do you know how that works?
Yeah, they have a public matching program, and that's what this program would set up. It would set up a public match program so that public funds would match private contributions made to folks running for Congress. And, you know, the problem with this, I think, is a very basic problem, which is why Americans are so opposed to it, is it is a fundamental violation of people's rights to say that their tax money is going to be used to subsidize the political campaigns of candidates running for Congress who they would never give money to on their own and they would never vote for in a voting booth. And yet that's the kind of thing they are setting up under this provision. And by the way, they're making it much tougher to actually criticize elected officials because of changes. We're concentrating on election administration, but there are numerous changes being made to federal campaign laws, including to the structure of the Federal Election Commission, where I once served as a commissioner, that are clearly meant to make it very difficult, particularly for nonprofit groups, to criticize members of Congress when they are debating and voting on particular bills on important issues there, like gun control and abortion.
One of the characteristics, I think, of this whole process is that by lumping it all together, it's sort of a collection of horrors. And you know, there's a very real possibility that they're going to ram it through the Senate the same way. And I think that the threat here, both to our freedom as voters and to our freedom in terms of citizens speaking out. And this is sort of a dual negative, if you will, coming right at us. And it seems to me that one of the fascinating things is that the media is paying virtually no attention to the details of the bill. So you hear For the People Act, well, that sounds good. I'm for the people. But then when you begin to realize that this is really a corrupt politician empowerment act, that it would be totally different if people understood just how many bad things there are in here.
Oh, I agree with that. The media is parroting the talking points that the left has come up with of claiming that, well, if you're against this bill, you're trying to suppress votes and you're a racist, which of course is not true. In fact, many of the provisions in this bill will impact voters, including minority voters. Just a quick example of one of those is the fact that it requires states to count the ballots of individuals who vote outside of their assigned precinct. Now, that will lead to the direct disenfranchisement of voters, because that means that this bill would encourage people not to vote in their assigned precinct, to show up on the other side of the county or city where they live to vote. And what they may not understand when they do that is that the ballot they're going to be handed, while, yeah, they may be able to vote for and be qualified to vote for a statewide candidate or who's going to be president of the United States, by not voting in their precinct, they are not going to be entitled to, and they won't be able to vote for members of Congress because they're in the wrong part of the county. They will miss being able to vote for city council and state legislators that they would be able to vote for in their assigned precinct. Democrats want those votes for president for their candidate, but they're not concerned about voters being disenfranchised from other state and local races and even congressional races.
I'm just thinking about the mechanics of it. I vote in a precinct where, depending on where you live in the precinct, you are in a different legislative district. So when you sign in, they give you the ballot for your geographic neighborhood. And as I'm listening to your talk, I'm thinking, you're really talking about almost a random behavior where you can show up anywhere to vote. And it's hard to know how they would track back to figuring out which county commissioner or state legislator, et cetera, you should vote for, because you will be totally outside the normal system.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. In particularly large counties, there's no way they can have a ballot for every single precinct in that county. So inevitably, there are many races you won't be able to vote for. Plus, look, if you can show up at any random precinct anywhere in a county, you know, the only reason election officials know how many ballots should be in a particular precinct for a particular day is based on the number of voters who are assigned to that precinct and vote there. And this rule will mean that if many people show up at a more convenient polling place, the likelihood that that polling place is going to run out of ballots is highly likely, and even more people are going to be disenfranchised because of what is really a foolish change in the rules that H.R. 1 would mandate.
The other part of that is, it seems to me that the Constitution is very unequivocal about the power of state legislatures in establishing the rules for elections. And I don't see how they think they're going to pass constitutional muster with preempting all of the state laws. What is your reading of that?
Well, the devil is in the details. As you know, there are two different election clauses in the Constitution. You know, one deals with presidential elections, and that one pretty much gives entirely authority to the state legislatures to set up the rules for presidential elections. When it comes to congressional elections, it does hand it over to the states unless Congress wants to step in to alter the time, place, and manner of elections. On the other hand, even with congressional elections, the one part of congressional elections that is 100% given authority to the states is the qualifications to vote in a federal election. That's why, for example, as you recall, Newt, when we decided to lower the voting age from 21 to 18, Congress first tried to do that with legislation. They couldn't do it that way. It had to be a constitutional amendment because it was entirely up to the states to do that. My point of all this is, I think there are many provisions in this law that are unconstitutional and that violate the qualifications clause, which says the states have 100% authority over it, and violate the presidential elections clause, which again, the states have 100% authority over it. Unfortunately, there are other parts of this bill that probably the Supreme Court would say fall within the time, place, and manner power of Congress, even though they're really, really bad policies.
The citizens of Arizona have a similar kind of attitude in that by 66 to 15, they oppose Washington overturning state laws. There's an instinctive sense among the American people that they prefer to keep power decentralized and that they prefer not to have Washington politicians establish one size fits all, and it happens to be the size Nancy Pelosi wants.
Now look, that's clearly the correct attitude, and I certainly agree with it. I don't think it's just Arizona. I think people in almost all the states agree with that.
When you go through this bill and you realize how many provisions the country strongly on the other side, for example, 80% of the country thinks you should be able to require citizenship verification. Are they just counting on people not noticing it? Or how do they think they're going to survive voting for something that is this much opposed by the American people?
I think they're counting on the fact that, as you pointed out, this is a huge bill. It takes time to delve into all the details and find all the really bad portions of it. The media is painting this picture that this is a wonderful bill. It's just intended to make sure everybody has access. So I think they're counting on, frankly, the ignorance of the American people, the mainstream media, to keep the American people ignorant about it. And if they can get it passed, they believe that the changes in the rules, the manipulation of election results that they'll be able to do because of this change in the rules will frankly be enough to keep them in power. And I think, unfortunately, that's the goal.
So from that standpoint, it's really important, it seems to me, for the American people in the next few weeks to be contacting their senators and getting across their opposition to H.R. 1, the For the People Act.
I totally agree with that. And you gave a great example of that. You know, you talked about the fact that Representative Thompson of Mississippi was a sole Democrat voting against that. And, you know, he talked about this and he said he actually likes many of the provisions of the bill, but he voted against it. Why? Because his constituents told him they didn't like this bill. They particularly didn't like, for example, public funding of people running for Congress. They didn't like other portions of the bill, too, because they believed it basically was taking away the right of Mississippi voters to decide on their own what the rules were for elections in their state. And I think that's exactly the same kind of message that needs to be given to U.S. senators from citizens all over the country.
By contrast, a number of the states have been passing election reform bills that are designed to make the election more reliable, more accurate, to make certain that only real citizens are voting. Do you want to comment for just a second on this strange phenomenon that you have at the state level? You have a wave of reform, almost all of which are exactly the opposite of H.R. 1.
Yeah, it's state legislators who are closest to their constituents. I mean, they're the ones who've gotten numerous calls that they need to fix the vulnerabilities in the election system to prevent what happened last year from happening again. And that's why we're actually seeing many good efforts to reform election laws. I mean, a great example is your old state where you were a congressman, Georgia. Georgia's got an election reform package. I think it's already passed the state house. It's now the state senate. And one of the smartest things it does is it extends Georgia's voter ID requirement, which has been in place for more than a decade, very successfully, but it only applied to in-person voting. And the reform bill would extend it to absentee balloting, which was probably the biggest bone of contention in last year's election. It also would ban state and local election officials from receiving private funding and private grants from outside organizations. As you know, that happened in last year's election, something like $450 million, a lot of it contributed by Mark Zuckerberg, was given to election officials in particularly large amounts in urban districts, Democratic strongholds, to, in essence, have the Democratic Party and Democratic activists take over the running of elections in those districts. And that may have made a difference in the outcome of the election. They're trying to now ban that kind of private money, which is a clear conflict of interest for election officials to receive.
You know, I wondered at the time how it could be legal for a private citizen to put up that kind of money on a clearly discriminatory basis. The amount of money some of these cities were receiving was astonishing. And it took the control over the city budget out of the hands of the city council and put it into a negotiated contract with Zuckerberg's organization. I thought the whole thing had to be illegal, but it doesn't seem to, in fact, have been followed up on in any serious way. By itself, it was probably decisive in a number of states in changing the pattern of the turnout by just the sheer volume of money that Zuckerberg was putting in.
That's really true. To illustrate what you just said, Philadelphia, I think the appropriated amount that the city of Philadelphia had for its election department was a little under $10 million for the election. They got $10 million from Zuckerberg and his organization. I don't know if you've seen this, but within the last week or so in Wisconsin, the legislature made public internal emails from Green Bay, which indicated that the registrar there who resigned shortly before the election apparently resigned in disgust because Green Bay received a large amount, is a large urban area, Democratic stronghold, and Democratic activists were brought into the election department and in essence, it seems, took over the running of the election there. So it was as if the Democratic Party was running the election, not nonpartisan election officials in Green Bay. And that, I think, unfortunately reflects what may have been happening in other places too.
I'm really struck, having watched a lot of elections in my career, I was struck that it wasn't any single thing, but that there was a nationwide surge to push the margins in so many different directions. And that it actually was a 2 or 3 year campaign. It wasn't an election day, but it was a continuing unending process. And I actually think that we're drifting towards a crisis about oligarchs. You know, when you have Bloomberg drops $100 million into Florida specifically to beat Trump and fails, but nonetheless, $100 million serious money. When you have a California internet billionaire who drops $18 million into Texas the last week to try to beat the Republican senator running for re-election, John Cornyn. This is, I think, when you combine this level of money with a desire to shape power, you begin to move back into the kind of problems we had with John D. Rockefeller or the railroads or any of the great oligarchies of the past, except these tend to be personal, not corporate. I think we're going to have to really rethink how we protect. Essentially, the election is designed to protect the citizens' right to fire somebody they don't want and to send a signal about the policies they do want. And if that collapses, it seems to me you've lost all of the things we think of as a free society.
I agree with that. And H.R. 1, if it becomes law, will take us far down that road, which is the wrong road to go. I think it was National Review actually had a headline recently that saying that H.R. 1 is an assault on democracy. And I think that is absolutely true.
Let me remind all of our listeners that to oppose H.R. 1, you can call your senators. You call the U.S. Capitol switchboard 202-224-3121. A switchboard operator will connect you directly with the Senate office you request. That's 202-224-3121 and tell your two senators to oppose H.R. 1 and you will really be helping dramatically preserve freedom in America. Hans, I really thank you for joining me on this very important concept and helping people understand how big the gap is between the propaganda language and the reality.
I thank you for having me on. And for folks who are doing that, they can actually go to the website of the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org, and we have a fact sheet there about H.R. 1 that summarizes all of these worst provisions that we were talking about today.
That's great. And on our show page, we'll both have the phone number for the U.S. Capitol to call your senator, and we will add a connection back to the things that they have at the Heritage Foundation. It'll be on our show page at newtsworld.com. And I really appreciate the amazing work you do, making a real difference in the survival of freedom in this country. So thank you again very much, Hans.
Thanks, Newt.
Thank you to my guest, Hans von Spakovsky. You can read more about H.R. 1 on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at Gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.